Of course they'd count. How could they know how she felt? Zero had a new thought. If she could impress the numbers, that'd give her value. She'd leap, she'd soar, she'd sizzle, she'd shine. She'd make a grand entrance and floor them all. So Zero began to roll faster and faster and faster. She leaped, flying, soaring, rocketing right into one, who knocked over two, who fell into three and four, toppling five and six, who crashed into seven and eight, where they all ended up in a big pile of on nine. All the numbers were bent out of shape. "It's no use trying," sobbed Zero. "I'll never have value. I'll never be part of the count," she said. "It's what's inside that counts most," pointed out Seven. Zero looked at herself. "But what if I don't have anything inside?" "Every number has value," said Seven. "Be open. You'll find a way." Suddenly, Zero saw herself in a new light. "I'm not empty inside. I'm open." Zero rolled up to all the numbers. "I thought of a way for us to count even more," she said. "Count more?" asked Four. "Count us in," exclaimed Seven. "Lead the way," said One. "Everyone counts," the number shouted. Zero jumped in. Then she leaped up high and said, "Here is something new we can try. If we help each other soar, we can count even more. Let's count again, starting with 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90. And what's next? 100, 1,000, 10,000, 100,000, 1,000,000. We do count more, they cheered. Zero and the numbers explored and they had fun, bringing more value to everyone. And this time when she looked at herself, she felt whole right in her center. Thank you all.
For sharing joys and sorrows. You may express your personal triumphs and sorrows. Please come forward if you wish and keep your statements concise.
Good morning. I'm Sarah, for those of you who don't know me. And last summer, many of you recall that my husband had a period of severe illness and a lot of complications that kept him bouncing back and forth between hospitals and nursing homes for 3 months. And it was a very difficult summer for us. Fortunately, he's walking just fine these days. That's only half of it. The other part, of course, was that his body was attempting to reject his donor kidney. We are going through another surgery on Friday morning in an attempt to continue to save the donor kidney. So please keep us in your hearts, keep us close. We've got several weeks of recovery ahead of us, and let's hope this works, because otherwise it's a life back on dialysis. Thank you.
This Friday, Jason and Julie and I are all going to be in a show for International Women's Day at 8 p.m. at its stages. There are details on this postcard that will be on one of the tables in the back. And also, this last week, I celebrated my baby's 18th birthday. So I'm pretty excited about that. She's here with me today.
Good morning. I'm Mary Botts. And some of you know that I've been going through an issue since December with my driver's license. And it all had to do with my surgery 2 years ago, that when I reapplied for my driver's license, I marked the wrong box. And it became this whole investigation thing. So I haven't been able to drive since December 19th. And thanks to family and friends, I have been taken care of very well. People have been so accommodating. I really appreciate it. Wednesday, I took my driving test and passed. Yay! And tomorrow, I get my driving license back.
My name is Eleanor. And I have a joy. One of my piano students, he is in sixth grade, and he has officially been in remission for 18 months. So it's really exciting, and his parents are obviously really happy, but I am too, because he's just a sweet little kid. So thank you.
Hi there. My grandmother-in-law, my husband's grandmother, passed away on Wednesday at 98 years old, surrounded by all the loved ones. And I'm grateful to have been able to know her for the last 5 years of those 98. So Liv, I'd like to light a candle for their family.
I have a joy. My name's Donette. I'm getting a new grandchild, due date April 3rd. Haven't said much about it because it took close to 6 years for this to happen, with a lot of problems and miscarriages, etc. So this child is very, very wanted, and we are very excited. Unfortunately, it's in Los Alamos, New Mexico, so I'm going to be gone for about 3 weeks. Anyway, we're really happy in our family.
Invite us to close our eyes and get comfortable in our seats as we move into this time of silent reflection and contemplation. As we breathe a few nice deep breaths together, we quiet our minds, we let go of the concerns of the day, the week behind us, and the week ahead of us. And we follow the empty breath. We come back to that image of the ill-matched threads of our lives and how much we long to weave those threads together into whole cloth. As we breathe into that longing, we also leave room for what seems to be the way of life, the coming together and the falling apart, the weaving together and the unraveling. We breathe into the peace and stillness beneath the way things seem to be. Let us be together in a moment of silence. Peace be with us and with all under the sun.
the doctor will say. She hasn't been well since the day that she fell, and the bruise, it just won't go away. So she sits and she waits with her mother and dad, and flips through an old magazine till the nurse with the smile stands at the door and says, "Will you please come with me?" Sarah Beth is scared to death, 'cause the doctor just told her the news. Between the red cells and white, something's not right, but we're gonna take care of you. Six chances in ten, it won't come back again. With the therapy we're gonna try, it's just been approved, it's the strongest there is, and I think we're in it this time. And Sarah Beth closes her death as she sits holding her mom. 'Cause it's been a mistake for someone to take a girl with no hair to the prom. For just this morning, her pillow was the cruelest of any surprise. And she cried when she gathered it all in her hands, the proof that she isn't, she can't deny. And Sarah Beth closes her eyes. She dreams she's dancing around and around without any care. This morning, where his hair had been, softly she touches just skin. And they go dancing round and around without any care. Her very first true love is holding her close. And for a moment, she isn't scared. For a moment, she isn't scared.
This piece is called The Cure by Albert Hofstetler. We think we get over things. We don't get over things. Or say we get over the measles, but not a broken heart. We need to make that distinction. The things that become part of our experience never become less a part of our experience. How can I say it? The way to get over a life is to die. Short of that, you move with it. Let the pain be pain. Not in the hope that it will vanish, but in the faith that it will fit in, find its place in the shape of things, and be then not any less pain, but true to form. Because anything natural has an inherent shape and will flow towards it. And a life is as natural as a leaf. That's what we're looking for. Not the end of a thing, but the shape of it. Wisdom is seeing the shape of your life without obliterating or getting over a single instant of it. Now, let us greet Michael Esalen.
Good morning. A number of years ago, I was speaking to this very congregation, which at the time included a question and answer period with the speaker as a part of the Sunday morning service. And that morning, I had given a talk of mine called I Don't Have a Suit, that has to do with our experience of feeling like an insider or an outsider. And during the Q&A, one woman shared with the congregation the pain of having to recently admit her elderly father into an assisted living facility, where she explained there was assigned seating in the dining room. Unbeknownst to my dad, she said, he got seated at the cool table because soon enough, one of the other residents rolled up alongside him and commented sadly, that used to be my place until you got here. Bad news, folks. It seems like in some ways we never get out of junior high. I attended Jefferson Junior High in Long Beach, as my father had some 30 years earlier. In fact, when he was 12 years old, he was across the street from the school on his bicycle, having wrapped up his paper route late one Friday afternoon in March 1933, when the big earthquake hit. And he watched as his school collapsed into a heap of rubble. Far from rubble in my mind, Jefferson is a time and place that still lives very vividly in my consciousness, and like it or not, it was a shaping force in the person I would become and how I would come to see my place in the world. Yeah, middle school, junior high can be a potent time for many of us, a time of getting one's bearings, a time of self-discovery, for many a time of desperate yearning to belong, and yet always feeling the outsider. For some, a time of enormous cruelty, either as the victim or perpetrator, or both. And for some, a time of terrifying vulnerability. I was a gay 11-year-old boy when I started at Jefferson, and it was the first time I ever had to get naked in front of other little boys, suit up for PE, shower together. Gerald Colucci had chest hair in seventh grade. Some of the other boys clearly hadn't begun puberty yet. My God, my memories of those times, the people, the places, they are fixed in a 13-year-old's perceptions. And it can take years to tease apart those perceptions and begin to see one another, including ourselves, in a truly multidimensional way. Perhaps some of you saw the recent film Eighth Grade. It is a devastating, achingly poignant portrait of this rite of passage, shot through an utterly contemporary lens, and yet in some ways only going to prove the old adage that the more things change, the more they stay the same. In the film, Kayla is 13, and she's enduring the last week of classes after a disastrous eighth grade year. Kayla makes these little shoebox time capsules, including a video time capsule, as a sort of gift and touchstone to her future self. She had made one for herself upon graduating elementary school to the future middle school graduate, whom she had imagined would have it all figured out by now, and that life would be sweet. Much in the same way many of us might have imagined once upon a time that life will be so much easier once we get to be an adult. This talk is kind of the opposite of such a time capsule in a way. Rather than reaching forward in time, I'm reaching back to a few specific characters at Jefferson, teachers more precisely, who are fixed in my time capsule of memory in at most two dimensions. And if I dare to see them in a multidimensional way, what might I discover about myself? Did any of you ever find it nearly impossible to conceive of your teachers as human beings, having a normal life outside of the classroom? I mean, we might have known if they were married or had kids, but just couldn't quite wrap our heads around it. Perhaps it's a function for those in my generation for whom teachers showed up to work in dresses, suits, and ties. It was hard enough to imagine them in casual clothes, let alone living a normal life. I remember how shocking it was to see Mr. Keller getting an ice cream cone at a thrifty drugstore. Or to see a teacher cry. Mrs. McCants was the first African-American teacher I ever had. Eighth grade English. I just adored her. I can still sense how disorienting it was to see her openly weep in front of the class on Friday, April 5th, 1968, the day after Martin Luther King had been assassinated. It was impossible to conceptualize the magnitude, the gravity of such an event for her, for any of us, really. I was coming of age in this narrow slice of time in which assassinations had become the norm. It's taken decades to hold the magnitude of such events in a larger historical context. A few years ago, Ted Othier, an old friend from the neighborhood and a fellow altar boy at Our Lady of Mount Carmel Church, sent me an email including a link to a then 12-year-old obituary for Claude Evans. Claude had been our ninth grade geometry teacher at Jefferson. Now, Teddy, who sadly passed away himself recently, knew everything about everybody and every place that had been our world in Signal Hill and Long Beach during those years. Everybody should have a Teddy. I remembered Mr. Evans mostly as a big, bald, humorless, seemingly ancient man in his mid-50s with a deep voice and bad breath and chalk dust always flocking the dark suits he wore, the residue of so many triangles and parallelograms drawn on the chalkboard. Mr. Evans also led the after-school slide rule club, if you can imagine. Dorkosaurus that I was, I showed up for the first few meetings with my little slide rule from Savon Drugstore, though I lost interest pretty quickly. But don't you know, when it came time to take yearbook photos for campus clubs, I and many of my friends showed up for that slide rule club photo because, hey, it was a chance to get out of class. We thought we were so clever. Mr. Evans is fixed in my memory as little more than a cartoon. And yet when I read his obituary, I was filled with such tenderness and regret for the man I never got to know, though I had spent an hour with him every day for a year. I didn't know he'd served in the Army Air Corps, as my dad had during World War II. I didn't know he'd been co-captain of a Rose Bowl-winning football team from Berkeley. I couldn't have known that he lost an adult son in 1984. But the line that pierced the deepest revealed what I really didn't know. Anyone who knew Claude knew, most importantly, that he was one who would help anyone in need. And he would do so with a smile and warmth and no expectation of anything in return. The 13-year-old within me did not recognize this portrait at all and felt ashamed. The 60-something-year-old man only felt sorrow for this missed opportunity to connect, with an extra layer of sadness because it was already a 12-year-old obituary, as if that somehow solidified that this was an opportunity gone forever. Much in the same way, many of us might have feel an extra layer of sadness when we hear many years after the fact that someone we loved or cared about once has died. Leaves me to wonder how little we ever really see and can know of each other. Well, 20-some years ago, late in August, on a Friday afternoon after work, I drove down to Long Beach to meet an old college friend of mine, Carrie, to go kayaking on the Alameda Bay. Carrie and I had both grown up in Long Beach, even went to the same high school, though we didn't know each other there. We met a few years later in an engineering class at UCLA. But the Bay was a place that for each of us held these indelibly joyful memories of times growing up in Long Beach. So as we paddled around, we did a lot of, oh, I remember one time, and did you ever go over there? And you remember the popsicles they sold at Woody's Goodies? It was truly an enchanted afternoon. As the sun began to set, we turned our kayaks in, and though I was soggy and a little sandy, we walked down 2nd Street through Belmont Shore to go grab some dinner at a now long-gone Long Beach institution, Hoff's Hut. Even then, though, it had lost all the tacky familial charm we had remembered. It had become sort of slick and hip and corporatized. But as we were walking down 2nd Street toward the restaurant, I commented to Carrie, I have the strangest sensation that I'm going to bump into somebody from my distant past. Isn't that weird? We went into the restaurant, gave the hostess our name. I turned around and could not believe my eyes. There sat my 8th grade gym teacher, Mr. Limeburger, the devil incarnate. Never quite like the other boys, gym class seemed only designed to drive that point home. And as if the other boys couldn't be counted on to underscore that difference every single day, Mr. Limeburger could be counted on to bring up the rear. Esalen, you mean to tell me you can't jump over that? You couldn't throw farther than that? You couldn't make that basket? Go give me 2 laps. There he sat, still a large man, still with close-cropped hair, still with no neck, but now with a cane and a face slightly askew that led me to think he'd likely had a stroke. I pointed out the materialization of my premonition to Carrie, my 8th grade gym teacher. She whipped a camera out of her purse right away and said, well, you got to go say hi, quick, I'll take your picture. I knew she was right, of course, but not for the reason she would have suggested. I knew this was a threshold for me to cross because I knew if I say hello to him, I will also have to come out to him because sooner than later, a question will be asked about wife and kids. Excuse me, are you Mr. Limeburger? Well, yeah, who are you? I reintroduced myself and offered my hand to shake. And he took it, but he did not let go. He pulled me down to sit right next to him, not letting go of my hand. And for the next few moments, I was his captive audience. And I got the entire encapsulated version of the 40 previous years. I had heard all about the wife, the kids, the grandkids, the retirement, the stroke. And then he finally said, so what about you, Mike? How many kids you got? None, I answered. Well, why not? What's your wife do? Here we go. Well, I'm not married. I'm gay. I live with a man. I've shared my life with him for 19 years now. The silence hung there in the air in a moment as awkward as junior high itself. Well, he looked around as if hoping someone would offer him a Q-tip to clean out his ears or something, as if he'd heard me incorrectly. Are you shitting me? He said. No. No, I'm not. Again, the silence hung there. And I realized that this too was a threshold that I had spent my entire life carrying a sense of apology for being gay, making adjustment, accommodation to everyone else's discomfort, to the awkwardness. And for once, I was giving it back. Here. You deal with it. He fussed and fumbled for a bit. And he finally spit out, well, that's okay with me, I guess. Gee, thanks. More to comfort himself than me, really. But just then the hostess called our name and we were seated for dinner and that was that. But I have to say, through the entire meal, my heart did not stop pounding in my chest. I thought my chest would explode. He was not a feeble old man in that moment, and I was not an out, proud, 40-something, self-actualized gay man. I was 13, and I had just come out to my gym teacher. Sam Sanders, the host of the NPR podcast, It's Been a Minute, recently observed that coming out is not just declaring yourself to the world, it's declaring yourself to each earlier version of yourself. And letting that person know that they're cool too. Yeah, PE was by far the most torturous aspect of Jefferson for me. It all started day 1, 7th grade. My teacher that year was Mr. Dennis. He was a short, affable enough man with a Detroit haircut, short flat top on top, held up with butch wax, long on the sides, combed behind the ears. Even in 1966, that haircut was a few years out of date. Mr. Dennis showed an obvious preference for the more athletic boys in class, and they returned the favor by affectionately calling him Coach. Day one, first day, PE, seventh grade, after the trauma of suiting up, he tested us on how far we could throw a football and how many times we could hike it between our legs and hit the center of a bicycle inner tube hanging on the chain link fence behind us within some specified period of time. I was a big sissy boy who would rather practice my waltz steps out in right field than focus on any baseball game. I had never touched a football, let alone thrown one. I got an F, the first in my life. Mortified, humiliated, I can still feel the shame and disgrace of being summoned into Mr. Meyer's office, a seventh grade counselor, and told I was to be placed in special PE, which was PE designed for boys with special needs, disabilities, handicaps, more commonly and disparagingly referred to as ortho PE. And if you appeared to be able-bodied and were in ortho PE, you might as well change schools. You're not going to survive. I confronted Mr. Dennis the next day. Did you recommend that I be put in special PE? Kind of ballsy when you think about it. Sheepishly, he answered yes. I think also kind of knowing he was also condemning me to a kind of social death sentence. My only saving grace in the end was that the gifted math class met in the same period as special PE. And so math trumped out over football, and I was relegated to regular PE, where I spent a lot of time on benches, surreptitiously mapping out cha-cha steps with my feet tucked under the bench. The crazy irony is that very few years later, I began a career as a professional dancer. Physical ability, coordination, agility were not my issue. But because I didn't fit the cultural norms of what a boy was expected to like, and didn't excel at the things at which a boy was expected to excel, I was somehow seen as an affront to that culture. And I was labeled handicapped because of it. But you know what? I'm almost over it. In that same email that Ted sent me with the link to the obituary for Mr. Evans, there was also a link to an article about Mr. Dennis. This one from the Salt Lake City Daily Herald. James Dennis, 73, retired middle school teacher, former bishop in the Mormon Church, was convicted and sentenced to 20 years to life for the sexual assault and molestation of 17 girls, four of whom were his granddaughters. His son Gary is quoted in the article as saying it's believed his father assaulted his first victim some 50 years earlier. That would have meant Mr. Dennis's little enterprise had been well underway when I had been his student. Another close friend of the family was quoted as saying, "We were all so shocked. If only we had seen something, maybe we could have done something to stop it." Yeah, the things we don't see. Almost more chilling than the headline was the mugshot included in the article. Of course, the Detroit haircut was long gone. And despite the orange jumpsuit and the now sagging jowls, it was most definitely my tormentor. Same cold blue eyes staring blankly in the camera with this expression that was not so much a grimace or a scowl so much as it was surrender. The jig is up. It's all over. Complete and total disgrace. Now, if this article had been about any other stranger, any perpetrator, I'm certain my response would be moral outrage and disgust, lock the bastard up, throw away the key. And given whom he represents in my own biography, I thought there might have been another layer, a flavor of schadenfreude, if you will, delight in his demise. But neither was the case. I only felt deep, profound sadness. And I have to admit, my sadness in that moment was not for his victims, but for him. Not only sadness, but a kind of softness. For him, for the perpetrator of these crimes. And I'm left wondering about that sadness and about that softness. Here, this article in the Daily Herald confronts my 13-year-old perceptions of who Mr. Dennis was. And as with each of these stories, I watched as those perceptions crumbled right before my eyes, just like Jefferson itself crumbled right before my father's eyes in 1933. And it leaves me to wonder if such earthquakes aren't such a bad thing, metaphorically speaking, giving us a chance to reinterpret that which we thought was so solid and unchanging, giving us a chance to see through walls that hid things that should have been seen. It took 50 years to bring him to justice, after all. But I come back to why sadness, why softness? Is it because, like it or not, Mr. Dennis and I did share a metaphorical minute waltz in the cosmic dance of our lives, and so he puts a human face on this inhuman deed? Is that it? Is it because of some deep sense of inherent worth and dignity? Perhaps, but I don't think so. Could it be something approaching authentic compassion, if only for the humiliation, the complete degradation of another human being? I don't know. I only felt and feel profound sadness. In the film, Eighth Grade, Kayla opens the time capsule she had made for herself upon graduating elementary school. And when she's confronted with the unmet dreams, hopes, expectations, she finds it too painful, overwhelming, in fact. She asks her father to be a witness to a ritual burning of the time capsule, not wanting to leave a trace of evidence of all those unmet hopes and expectations. Even while her father plaintively asks her, "Are you sure?" I know I didn't want her to burn it either. Now, if Mr. Dennis had made a time capsule for himself at 13, for himself at 73, I'm pretty sure it would not have included that mugshot or that orange jumpsuit. But then again, had I made one for myself at 13, for myself at 64, there's very little in my life that I could have imagined, the joy or the pain of it. I certainly couldn't have imagined ever being an oncology chaplain. Possibly most inconceivable in 1966 would be that I'd be sharing my life with Scott for over 40 years as an out, proud, legally married gay man who still can't throw a football. So what about you? What might your 13-year-old self have imagined about you today? What, if anything, might you have to say to him or her? Might those earlier versions of ourselves know deep in their bones that they're cool too? May there be love. May there be compassion. May there be room for all of us at the cool table. So be it. Thank you.
Our offering is a vital way we show our gratitude for this community. By giving to UUCF, we know that this community of caring will continue to do its good work in the world. We thank you for your generosity.